I'm Sandy Klein. Welcome to another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. Maureen Sullivan, in a word, whoa. Make that wow. Briefly, the 31-year-old who, when she was a senior at Stanford, interviewed for the job of assistant to Larry Page and Sergey Brin, the co-founders of Google. She was hired. Along the way, she moved from her home and job in California to New York, where Maureen served as chief of staff for Tim Armstrong, who ran sales and marketing, a position she held from 2005 to 2009. Armstrong is no longer at Google. Neither is Maureen. He left in 2009 for AOL, taking her with him. Armstrong, by the way, is AOL's CEO. As for Maureen, she was senior vice president of brand, marketing, and communications, overseeing global brand development and AOL's marketing and corporate communication initiatives. She was also a member of the executive leadership team. Maureen's current title is Senior Vice President and General Manager of Women's Content and Lifestyle Brands. She launched and oversees Makers, an unprecedented digital video and broadcast initiative that tells the story of the last 50 years of the American women's movement and brings to life the stories of exceptional women. The 3-hour documentary aired on PBS earlier this year. Clearly, Maureen Sullivan is a maker, and I am so excited, honored, and lucky to have her here today. Welcome, Maureen.
Thank you.
So much for that line, age is just a number. At 31, you've got a resume of a person twice your age.
Oh, well, that is nice of you to say, and that's one of the nicest intros I think I've ever had. I'll come hang out with you anytime.
Frame it and put it on your tombstone.
Exactly. That sounds great.
So take us back to your senior year at Stanford, if you don't mind traveling back.
Yeah.
Did your post-graduation plan include working at Google, and why?
You know, it didn't. I think like many seniors in college trying to figure out the next phase of their life, you know, you kind of opportunities kind of just sometimes stumble in front of you. And at that time, Silicon Valley was booming like it has been for many years. And Google was hiring. And there were a lot of Stanford graduates heading to Google, many people in my class and the classes for me and the ones to follow. So it was, you know, I think it was a special moment in time at that company in that it was really on the brink of scaling to what it is now, which is obviously an incredible global brand and organization really connecting the world. So, you know, that was not my master plan. My master plan was to get to New York. That was the vision. And the opportunity at Google allowed me that, which was, you know, the beginning of a really great, you know, last 10 years in New York City working in digital media, right? Which is, I think, not is kind of surprising. You know, it's a combination of the best of Silicon Valley, but, you know, the best of the media world, which is,
right,
of course, centered here in New York. So
when you joined Google in what year?
2004.
In 2004.
Yeah.
Were there many women there then?
You know, that's a great question. Yes, there were. I think that's one of the most impressive things about Google from a leadership perspective and the diversity of leadership, even at that time, even when the company was really small.
They started the company in 98, I believe.
They did. Right. And there were always really, really strong female leaders. You know, I guess I take that for granted that I had that, you know, my entire career, right?
It's partly, sure, after overseeing a project
like Makers, you know, it makes me realize how fortunate I've been to always have, you know, really groundbreaking female leaders as role models within the company. I had to look outside even my own company to have that example. And even when I started Google in New York, you know, at that time, New York was really, really a small office. There were, you know, primarily salespeople. And then we were starting an engineering office led by a brilliant engineer named Craig Neville Manning. And there were even female engineers in that very first small group of engineers here in New York, which is even more rare to find. But I think, that's one of the, I think, the blessings of my time at Google is just being exposed to incredible female innovators and leaders my entire time that I was there.
Did you major in business at Stanford?
No, I didn't. Stanford doesn't have an undergraduate business major. So I was a communications and American studies major. I double majored. And I had done worked in a computer science lab. There's a great professor, Cliff Nass, who teaches a combination communications and computer science course at Stanford. So I had taken that and become kind of fascinated and found my way into a lab. And I think that was close enough to computer science that it made my resume look a bit more interesting, which is frankly how I think I ended up getting that first job at Google.
So here you are. You're in California. And I think that I've read that your dad was a varsity coach, baseball coach at Stanford. So you pretty much grew up on campus.
I was a Stanford baby. Yeah, he is. My dad has been at Stanford. He went to Stanford and has been at Stanford now as a head coach for 39 years. So a lifelong, Stanford alum, and really has made his career in coaching the baseball team at Stanford.
So you moved to New York basically alone,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, no, I did. And I think there's a pull to New York. There's a reason why people from all over the world want to spend time in New York. And I think I felt like career-wise, what did I have to lose? And I thought, I'll never regret trying to live in New York. You know, I didn't know if it would be a 1 year, 2 year, or 3 year thing, but I knew that experience would make me, that much tougher. And, you know, I remember being a waitress in college and sitting in the back of the, right outside the main dining room, and with my notepad that I would take orders on, trying to do the math of what I needed to make to survive in New York. You know, that famous math we've all done at one time.
Of course.
Well, if I, buy ramen noodles, and I go out once a month,
right,
and it's, I think New York's an amazing city to spend any time in your career. I mean, a phenomenal place to start a career. But I encourage people, at any point in their career, you're never going to regret time in New York.
Now, tell me or describe for me your stepping up the Google corporate ladder.
Yeah. So I think, probably the hallmark of my entire career so far, I hate to say like right place, right time, but there is some element of that. But I would say, and this is advice I try to give when I talk to other people early on in their career, right place, right time, right attitude, or willingness to just kind of say yes and take things on, right? So when I was at Google in New York, there were very few corporate functions at the company. There were salespeople and there were engineers. There weren't really marketing people. There weren't corp comm people there yet. And that often happens if you're at a company at an early stage,
right,
or in a remote office of a company. And, in that kind of first year that I was there, Google IPO'd. So there was a focus in New York. Many of the executives were in New York. There was a lot happening in New York because that IPO was happening. So, there was an opportunity for me as a very inexperienced person to just step up and do a lot of the things that needed to get done.
People pointed at you and said, oh, Maureen,
hey, we need
do
someone
that
to organize. We have to do a, company all hands here from New York. Who can do that? We don't have a corp comm person here, and I think it's not being afraid to fail, because the expectations are low when you're at that point in your career. The bar is not, you set your own bar,
okay,
right, by over delivering and doing more than what's asked of you and expected of you. And, I see so many young people now want to be in such a directed career path too early. And I actually think some of the best career experiences are when your role is kind of undefined, which can feel a little scary coming to work every day when there's not someone telling you exactly what to do.
Exactly.
But that's how you get good, is by doing a lot of different things and surprising, different leaders and different people within your organization around the versatility that you can show,
So people gave you a lot of rope.
A ton of rope. And I think the challenge is you want enough rope to, really grow and take on new experiences, but not hang yourself, not kind of make a fatal mistake, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of the tenuous balance that allows you to achieve some really meaningful things, beyond your years of experience.
So Tim Armstrong,
yep,
is watching you.
Yes.
And he's also delegating responsibilities for you.
Yeah.
And so the two of you forge a pretty nice partnership.
Yeah. I mean, I think, anyone that's worked with Tim, and he's managed, now CEO of AOL for 4 years, long time at Google, has had an amazing career. He's a world-class leader. And I think when you are fortunate enough to work alongside or for a world-class leader, you learn lessons that you don't even know you're learning.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like I felt like I had osmosis.
Yes, I was just thinking
of
that
Tim
word.
Was a generous enough person to allow me to be in meeting after meeting that I had no business being in, right? But because I was there, I learned, incredibly valuable
lessons.
Well,
clearly he saw something in you too, Maureen. I mean, he probably doesn't suffer fools gladly.
Yeah, but I think, generous and really passing on the learnings in real time that he's experiencing as a leader. And I think that's a hallmark of a great leader. Not trying to master your craft, but realizing, to open yourself up and have people learn as you learn,
mm-hmm,
is actually actually the best kind of learning possible, you know?
So at some point in all of this work experience, you became much more connected to him work-wise, right? Because you were his number one assistant. Is that fair? Is that the right way to describe it?
Yeah, I think a lot of my job was focused on the external parts of his job, right? So he would go spend time with major customers or partners. And, you know, my job would really be connecting the dots. You know, after that, you go and have an hour-long great meeting. And then there's 30, you know, we all do that, right? Mm-hmm. Then there's 30 things you want to do and you, you know, 29 of them fall off the table. You know, my job was making sure how does that turn into action? So, you know, I think that was I think when you have that role for someone, you become accountable to them and they hopefully begin to rely and trust on your ability to get things done and move things forward. And, mm-hmm. you know, that was kind of the dynamic that we've had throughout our, you know, my time working for him.
So he was giving you more and more responsibility.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
And so describe what some of your roles were.
One of the first things that when Tim became CEO of AOL, you know, he did a lot of really interesting things to reignite the culture of the company, right?
Mm-hmm. So because AOL had its issues, right? It was kind of not left in the dust by Google, but wasn't it sort of?
Yeah, I think, you know, AOL is almost a 30-year-old internet company, right?
And mm-hmm. Which is old.
Which is old by internet company standards. And I think, you know, was when Tim took over the company, was in the midst of unwinding the, you know, Time Warner merger, which, you know, has been known as one of the worst mergers in the history of corporate America. So there had been a lot of kind of residual damage and mm-hmm. the company wasn't going in the right direction. And I think that was part of the challenge of what attracted Tim to the job. And it was interesting to me as an employee and thinking about, you know, it's one thing to be at a super high growth company like Google. It's another thing to get the experience of trying to change a company that was a growth company, then wasn't, back into a growth company.
Gotcha.
That's a totally different kind of leadership and business challenge. And one of the kind of initial things that Tim did was really setting out on a, what he called kind of a 100-day listening tour as the new CEO. And, you know, I think it's easy to kind of go into a new role or a new job or a new responsibility and get tunnel vision and think, okay, this is what I have to do in order to change this. I'm the anointed person. I've got to do this. And, you know, Tim's style, which I think is something I've tried to model a lot is in my career, is talk to people, listen to people. You know, you're a team as a company. And, you know, while a CEO, the responsibility of the company lies with you. You're only as great as
your employees,
mm-hmm. right? So, you know, it was really a global listening tour of talking to all of the employees.
And your office is all over the
all
place.
Over the world. Uh-huh. And making that commitment to go there and spend time with employees, every single employee that he could spend time with. And using that to really refine and set the strategy and the mission of the company at that moment.
So you did a lot of traveling.
Yeah, a lot of traveling. But, you know, that lesson of listen first, mm-hmm. you know, listen more than you talk.
And so you heard what everybody was saying and then either made changes or
reset the strategy and then set the company mm-hmm. to really we spun out of Time Warner at the end of that year in December of 2009, which is a pretty quick time frame to spin out of a major, you know, company like Time Warner. But mm-hmm. really, I think Tim felt like it was important for the company to feel independent and on its own and that kind of manifest destiny. Mm-hmm. And a huge opportunity that came to me as attached to that was really rebranding AOL, right? So that was part of the commitment we wanted to make in spinning out, becoming a publicly traded standalone company again. You know, we felt like the company needed a new brand and image, right, to reflect the changes that were happening inside the company. How do you best do that? You know, you show a visual sign to your consumer and to the customer that, you know, this is the new vision for what we're going to do as an organization. So, you know, the experience of doing a rebrand, you know, I had thought of myself as a creative person, but it's a totally different creative challenge to take on the rebranding of anything. And I joke that, you know, most executives shy away from doing a rebrand because it's a hard thing to do because people don't like change no matter what, right? And so changing—
Well, older people don't like
change. No one likes change. I mean, it's crazy. You know, Facebook will change one little thing and it drives people nuts, right? I think we're all creatures of habit mm-hmm. on some level. So, you know, most, I think, smart executives stay away from rebrands mm-hmm. because it's often wrought with, you know, a fair amount of controversy and hard to do it in a way that you feel creatively empowered, but then also make everyone happy, you know? But I didn't know any better. So I said, well, that sounds like an awesome challenge. I'll take that on. So, you know, the idea, I mean, you talk to so many brilliant creative people, but creativity at scale is really, really hard, meaning there's a rebrand of a company in like a brick and mortar, right? website, and that can take months and months and months to change out physical signs. But think about a rebrand in the digital age where all of us, the expectation is that instantly you can update and change everything,
right?
And so at AOL, all of our assets were, you know, physical assets, right? And digital assets, right? And that they're, you know, we felt like we can flip a switch at a certain moment in time and completely change out this brand, which I think there was no guidebook on how to do that. And that was just a totally different kind of creative challenge for me in thinking about what visually the brand should be. How does that connect to what's going on with the company and the strategy? And then, okay, well, that's great, but how do you make that happen, right? How do you make sure that when all of our consumers go to log on to AOL that next day, they experience it and understand it as well?
So you're on a ground floor of something really big, in spite of the fact that the company had been around.
Yeah.
It's not like you gave birth to AOL.
Totally, but it's a new opportunity for, I think, new leadership and new vision. And, you know, as the physical identity of the brand was, you know, one of the hallmarks of signaling change.
And now I guess I'm kind of projecting onto you a little bit as an older woman. You never doubted yourself. I mean, you just kind of went in there and took the bull by the horns. And again, the fact of the matter is that stuff didn't happen years and years ago.
Now I feel like there is just such an ability to take opportunity and run with it. And that
As a woman.
And I think I was scared as all heck. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. And I joke with a lot of people, you know, fake it till you make it is something you have to feel very comfortable with in your 20s and your career. And even into your – and if you're not feeling that same feeling into your 30s and 40s and 50s, then you're probably not taking on big enough challenges, right? If you feel like you're not doing something that's, you know, out of your comfort zone, then you're not stretching yourself to the boundary.
But you can feel that way and somebody can step on it.
Yes, yes.
You know,
yes,
and squash it.
Yeah. No, I think – one of the hardest parts, and I'd be interested in this question from all the amazing women that you talk to, I think it's really hard being a creative woman because I think that as women, this is stereotypical, we're hypercritical of ourselves. And sometimes we're hypercritical of others. But I think it starts with our own criticalness of ourselves, right? We overjudge ourselves.
Right.
And to be
tremendous
truly
self-doubt.
Creative mm-hmm. – you have to, like, try to put that fear and that feeling away, right? Because that – if you're hypercritical, it's hard to be really creative, right? Because you're so worried about what other people are going to think of that creative output,
right?
Whether it's a business-related creative output or a performance or, you know, this interview series that you're creating. You know, it's that fear holds back the level of creativity.
I think that's a very good point.
I think you're never going to erase that fear, right? And you're not – you can tell yourself you don't want to feel that way, but you're going to feel it. So the question is how do you manage that, right?
So how do you
rise above
that?
It? I mean, I think for me, I feel like the strength of the team that I'm working with
– that you're leading?
Yeah, that I'm leading and that are my call – like that to me has been – that quells it, right? Because when you have those moments of doubt, if you do have a confidant and a colleague that you trust or a group of people that are even work for you that you trust and that you feel like will give you honest answers to things, that's who I go to in my moments of doubt or fear.
What about a significant other?
A partner for sure. I mean, I think – you know, I have a great, you know, partner in crime who is a, you know, amazing sounding board for me. And yeah, I think who are those couple people in your life that you let in to that level, right? Whether it's a best friend or a parent or a sister or brother or your partner, or maybe it's a mix of all of them and they give you different opinions. I mean, you probably feel this way. I have different people I call when I want different advice, right?
Right.
And I think you need that kind of tribe.
Or
that
assurance,
counsel.
Too.
Yeah.
It's funny that for me, that even at my age, that I still feel the need to do that. And I'm grateful that the people I ask about aren't tired or not rolling, oh, here she is again with this, you know.
No, I think it's our human nature is that we want to help people.
But is it a female human nature?
I think it's more natural for us as women to want to talk about it. I think men are probably a little more inner circle about who they choose to share it with, whereas, you know, I think women – we're more open to thinking about beyond just immediate family. It's funny. I mean, Makers, which we'll talk about, it's fascinating. I mean, we had the opportunity to interview, you know, over 200 women now for video interviews for Makers. And it's so fascinating to me. The issues are the same, right? Whether it's Sandra Day O'Connor in 1947 or Oprah Winfrey in 1996 or, you know, Madeleine Albright or Sheryl Sandberg, you know, the issues are not changing, right? It's work-life balance, right? How do you, you know, manage the tug of professional and personal? Managing fear, right? How do you not hold yourself back and really, you know, make sure that you have limitless potential in what you're going after? I mean, these are common themes that keep reoccurring. And I am pretty sure that, you know, my daughter, who's 7 months old, will be, you know, asking herself these same questions in 30 years. And, you know, there's going to be a different set of challenges and nuances for her. But I fundamentally think that, you know, that these issues are not going away. I think things are getting better and things are improving.
Well, how are they getting better when you use somebody like a Marissa Mayer, the CEO of Yahoo? What's your thought about how she was kind of excoriated?
I think she is doing an incredible job being a leader of a company in change and transition. And, you know, being – I think what's challenging is we sometimes like to put people up on a pedestal and then try to tear them down simultaneously, right? And I think no matter how powerful of a leader you are one individual with your one experience, right? And you are trying to, you know, manage that experience, whether it's changes in your personal life or going through the experience of having a child or taking on a big new job. And you know, I think we want one person to be all things to all people, and I don't think that's realistic, no matter who that individual is, mm-hmm. right? So, I mean, I think that she has inspired some great conversation and dialogue, and you know, I think again the need to be hypercritical of a very smart, very accomplished, you know, dynamic leader who has really broke ground for women mm-hmm. in being hired, you know, as the first pregnant, you know, CEO. I mean, that's amazing. And I, you know, as a woman, I am thankful to her mm-hmm. for doing that. I am. I have appreciation for her breaking that ground. And I think, you know, however people want to critique her, you can't take away the accomplishment that she's had in her career and the amazing accomplishments that she has ahead of her for the rest of her career.
So let's go back to Makers.
Yeah.
How was that born? Was that your idea?
You know what? No. It was an amazing filmmaker, a creative luminary who you need to meet and interview, a woman named Dylan McGee, who is the founder and executive producer. And she is an incredible documentary filmmaker, has made films for HBO and PBS. And she really had the vision. It started with an idea to make a film on the women's movement, and she approached Gloria Steinem, and Gloria turned her down. Gloria said no. Gloria said, how can you tell the story of the modern American women's movement through just one person's eyes, you know? And really, the challenge should be there were hundreds and thousands of women that have experienced the last 50 years of the women's movement. Let's tell all of those stories, right? Well, that's a totally different production challenge, as you know.
Of course.
As a creative person. And, you know, Dylan really went back to the drawing board and thought about, how do I really do this? And I think realized the power of video on the web, and that was just kind of right at that moment in time where video was really exploding on the web. And I think had this idea of, well, what if I wasn't limited in the volume of stories that I could tell? And she met Tim Armstrong, our CEO and leader of AOL. And, you know, he believed in it instantaneously. I think he saw the power of the idea of what if you could capture all of these incredible women's stories and put them in one place? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Dylan and I often talk about it as almost like a documentary in reverse. So normally you do a documentary film, right? Or any creative person understands this process. You set out to do something and then you leave hundreds of hours on the cutting room floor, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. you're forced to cull it down to the best of the best, right? And I think the idea around Makers was there was always going to be a documentary, a three-hour film, but the content was so valuable, we couldn't leave any of it on the cutting room floor, right? So what ended up happening is instead of, you know, the normal model is you launch a documentary and then there's a companion website, right?
Okay.
Well, this model was let's put all of the content out there. Let's use the power of the web, the scale of video, and then the documentary will form for that. So it's from that library of content. And the other vision was really, you know, think about how you look at videos online today, right? And how most of us do. we don't tend to make it through things that are very long, unless we're watching a show on our iPad, right, or a long-form television show or movie. Most of us, someone sends you a link to a video, and, you know, think about the amazing talks that someone sent you, and it's about 18 minutes, and you think, okay, I'm going to listen to this, I'm going to get through it, I'm going to watch this, and then you're about 2 minutes in, and the phone rings, or an email pops up on your screen,
and you get distracted, yeah.
Right? So our vision was, you know, let's take advantage of short form. So we're going to have these long form interviews, but let's cut these videos down into short form clips so that it's very easy for people to watch these inspiring stories. And we could have just done long form interviews, but we felt like the library really needs to be, you know, done in a way that makes it super easy for people to consume this content. Because sometimes with super inspirational content, if it's not short, it doesn't catch on fire in the social world that, like you know, the cat videos, right?
Right.
You know?
Ad nauseum.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that was the whole premise of clipping them down into short form and then what we call kind of a structured database behind it. So tagging each of the videos by important topics, whether someone's talking about work-life balance or the impact of their parent or their aha moment or facing their biggest fear. And then there were kind of two ways to search the archive of content from a consumer standpoint. One would be you find the name of a person you love, whether it's Ellen DeGeneres or Oprah. All these women are makers on our site.
Mm-hmm.
Or another way is you're just interested in topics, you know, so you want to hear what 10 amazing women have to say about
politics.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes. So thinking about creating, you know, what makes a library valuable? The organization behind it, right? And how easy it is to kind of wade through that content. So that was, you know, that documentary in reverse really has created, you know, kind of a constantly growing library now.
So you're always adding?
We are always in production. So it's kind of the production, the shoot that never, ever, ever ends. So we announce a maker every week. We're kind of constantly filming incredible women's stories. Our mission with Makers is to be the largest collection of women's stories ever assembled.
Wow.
So the goal, like, we'll never be done with that. We'll never be able to plant the flag and say, we have enough now, right? And I think that the challenge is, you know, how do we take advantage of technology to really, really achieve that? You know, we are the largest collection of women's stories today, but we could be so much bigger than, you know, the 200 plus women that we have on the site today. We should have 200,000. We could have 200 million, right? We'll never be done.
So what are the means to that end? What are you going to do about that?
You know, the goal, one of the major things that we're working on is really how do you apply, you know, a technology that allows an everyday person to turn into a filmmaker. I mean, think of all of the incredible makers, the women in your life that you know. Think about the intergenerational idea of, I'd love to interview my 92-year-old grandma and preserve her story. So there's a preservation of story. I mean, I think we're huge fans of StoryCorps. That is, you know, really, really important. And I think the power of video, I think, is massive. And if we can teach people or empower people to better tell their stories, then that gets us closer to being this largest collection of stories ever assembled. And whether that story has value for just an immediate family, or it has value between two people, or value amongst a community.
In a classroom?
In an educational setting, I think our goal is to get as many stories as possible. And I think we've already seen that these stories have the power to inspire people everywhere, you know, everywhere around the globe.
So are you, in essence, the producer?
I oversee a portfolio of brands, women's content brands, of which Makers is one of them. So my team built Makers.com.
Okay.
And I work in partnership with the executive producer, Dylan McGee, and really building out the Makers platform. Part of the reason I think a lot of these stories of incredible women hadn't been told, it was almost overwhelming to pick who to tell, like, you know, what stories to film, because there's so many amazing women. And I think it's a great example of similar to what you're doing. Just get going and start, you know, having conversations and, you know, capturing
a lot
of this.
And not every woman has to be a household name. I mean,
yes,
that's sort of the thrust of
exactly
the concept of
and
this
it's
program.
And something we've seen with Makers. You know, I think we have many household names. We've got the Oprahs and the Hillary Clintons.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the unknown stories.
So give me an unknown story.
Catherine Switzer. Many people do know Catherine.
Catherine Switzer?
Catherine Switzer,
okay,
was the first woman to run a marathon.
In Boston.
Mm-hmm. Her story is incredible. You know, Brenda Berkman, first female firefighter in New York City. Amazing, incredible story. Maria Pepe, the woman who, as a little girl, wanted to play Little League, which turned into a many-year court battle to allow girls to play Little League. I didn't know Maria's story. How did I not know Maria's story, right? As a girl that played sports my entire life, having a father who's played baseball his entire life and been a baseball coach. So, you know, there's many of these women who didn't set out. They didn't have a PR agenda. They didn't set out to change history, but they found themselves in a position realizing that if they didn't fight, that they would, you know, set women back versus propel women forward.
You know, this is so empowering and at the same time really emotional.
Yes.
Too.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, these are the stories that make you cry and make you realize, wow, I mean, what a debt that we have to pay to these unknown heroes. And I often say, you know, Makers is about, you know, the stories that you know, but hopefully getting a new version on, you know, a story you think you know, whether it's a Christiane Amanpour-like person or, you know, other groundbreaking names of you know, strong individuals that are well known in our world.
Globally, are
yeah.
we also talking about women from Ghana and France and Tahiti?
So the documentary really focused on, and our first focus of Makers was telling the domestic stories because there were so many women right here in the U.S.
Of course.
Who we hadn't told their story. And our goal really in being the largest collection of women's stories is how do we go global? How do we get more global stories of women from around the world? I think many of our makers today are global role models. They just happen to be, you know, born and bred in the U.S. Mm-hmm. and have made their impact in the U.S. But I think their footprint is, I mean, the Gloria Steinem is a global
Well, of
role
course.
Model,
well, she's
right?
an institution.
Exactly. So I think we have that combination. But I would say, yeah, the more global stories the better. I mean, there's just so many places in the world that I think need these stories even more than we do here in the moment in time where they are and women advancing.
Might be nice to air those stories in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm curious. You were given this new title, this newly created position of
yep.
managing women's content
yep.
and lifestyle brands.
Yeah.
So we focused a lot on Makers.
Yeah.
What else does that entail?
So I have a number of different brands. One is a style and beauty site called Stylist, which
I guess
is
that never goes
away. I know, right?
Right?
People love style and beauty. I have a food site called Kitchen Daily. Which is focused on, you know, really what we like to joke are people who are the chefs of their own life. You know, all of us are chefs of our life, whether
well,
we want to be or not, right? And that, you know, I joke the only two things that matter to everyone are food and time. It's the two universal principles.
Okay.
And so that's another part of our portfolio. Fortunate to have a fastest growing wedding site called Style Me Pretty, which is if you know any young brides, it's really the go-to resource for the modern young bride. That's an important part of our portfolio. And, you know, I think really just in developing, you know, what are kind of next generation magazines
mm-hmm.
and that, you know, people are as the magazine business goes in decline,
right.
more and more, you know, women and men, I think, are looking for lifestyle related content online across their devices, whether they're on their iPad in their kitchen or on the go on their phone. And so my job is, you know, we have 34 million women coming to AOL every month. That's a massive opportunity. When I think about, we say as a team,
wow.
imagine you had 34 million women coming over to your house tomorrow, right? How stressed would you be? You know, you'd want everything to be great. And I think when you're in a...
It would be really hard to find a seat for everybody.
I know,
they
right?
come to my
what
house.
Would you serve, right? I joke, we want the wine to be chilled. You know, we want great hors d'oeuvres, you know. Uh-huh. And I think the fun part about the media business, and particularly digital media, which is why I love my job, is that, you know, it's a 24/7 business. You know, almost like the news business is a 24/7 business. Being in the media business is a 24/7 business. And that, you know, my front door, so these sites that we run, they're always open. They're open at 3 a.m. They're open at 8 a.m. And so what are we putting on those pages to really help women make their lives better, you know, whether we're inspiring them with a, you know, inspirational makers video
mm-hmm.
or something as silly as, you know, how to make chicken marsala, you know, how am I delivering that content in a way that is easy to use, inspiring, but functional?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we all want a blend of aspiration and inspiration, but show me how to do it and do it well and the right amount of time. So that's really, I think, the opportunity of that more and more people's businesses will turn into 24/7 businesses, right? This
you don't feel that it infringes on your personal life? I mean, are you always checking your email?
Yeah, you know, I think that's why you have an amazing team, right? Because I think it's thinking about how do you run a 24/7 business but not have it monopolize all elements of your life?
Do you feel you've compartmentalized your life very well as a new mom, a working woman. Are you a good role model?
I think I have days where I feel like I'm getting it right, and then I have days where I feel like I'm getting it all wrong. And I think, you know, anyone that tells you anything different than that is a robot or
or lying.
Or lying or not being their authentic self. So, no, I mean, I think I'm a student of every amazing woman that I encounter, right? And that I learn from how people – I learn from watching. Other people have the same challenges, you know. And I have one baby and I feel like I have a lot to figure out. So when I meet someone who has three or two or five, I say, tell me everything you know. Mm-hmm. What are all your tricks, right? Because I think there is no – template. There's no rule book of how to do it perfectly. I think you have to decide what matters to you, to your family. You know, what are your priorities?
Well, you're a work in progress.
I am a total, and I think I will be till my, you know, last breath. Mm-hmm. I think to say that I've planted the flag and I've figured out the perfect way to do it is, you know, life throws all sorts of, you know, curveballs at you, whether it's personal challenges or professional challenges, and it's, you know, how you manage that. And, you know, do you keep your priorities in check as attached to that? And those are the people I respect and admire the most. And that you kind of know whatever life throws at them, they have the kind of their character mm-hmm. keeps them centered and they're always focused on the right things. Right. And that to me is if you can do that, that's a model of a life well lived.
Well, you know, there's a line, the child is the father of the man. Here at 31, you're really
wow.
You seem to have gotten it. Maybe you're wise beyond your years. Now, that sounds patronizing for me, but I don't mean it to be.
No.
So what's in your future?
I think I'm busy right now. I mean, I think we have a conference that we've announced with Makers. We're going to convene an incredible group of women together in February of next year. So really what we're trying to do is make sure that on this mission of being this largest collection of women's stories ever assembled, that we do a good job of bringing women together as well. And that's a really important part, I think, of charting the next 50 years mm-hmm. of what's going to happen. You know, the documentary looked back on the last 50 years. What's going to happen in the next 50 years? I mean, imagine a group of women sitting in a room with a whiteboard plotting out 2013 to 2063.
63, wow.
And let's guess, when are we going to hit more milestones, you know, and even domestically but around the globe? You know, what year will we have a woman president? What year will we, you know, meet equal pay, right? So I think that's the conversation that I get excited about. It's less about learning from the past, but then thinking about how do we take the opportunities that we have today and what impact are you know, this generation going to make and what stories will someone want to be chronicling from us in 50 years.
That's a great way to end because I'm really glad that we could chronicle your story.
Oh, thank you. It was an honor to be here.
Well, it was really my pleasure. Join us again for another edition of The 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.